blessing.
You've been listening to Viewpoint with Chuck Crismeyer. Viewpoint is supported by the faithful gifts of our...
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing in the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And, well, for the time being, this next hour, they're going to be the views of our good friend William Federer, who's a writer, and, we haven't had him on for some time. We always look forward to having him as a guest. We're going to be talking about the Declaration of Independence, which we celebrated the birth of last Saturday. And I think people really have to go back to 1776 and look and see what was happening at that time. Certainly, if you look around the world, in most countries, people lived under some sort of an authoritarian rule. There was a king or an emperor, a dictator, or a pharaoh, you call him what you will, there'd always be somebody in charge. And then they were usually validated by somebody from the church. And, of course, in England, it was the Anglican church. In Europe, it was the Catholic church. And in other nations, it was other religions, but there was very few places where people were really free. Now, at least England had a parliamentary form of government, although it had a king, but there were restrictions placed on the king dating back to the Magna Carta in 1215, and then the British Bill of Rights, and certainly a number of laws in England that restricted the power of the king. But of course, here in the United States, why, the king would simply ignore the laws of England and was going to maintain control over the colonists here. And the people living in America wanted to be free. I mean, this has been the desire of people throughout all ages in all nations, and this is still the desire of people in all nations today. But there was a unique group of people here in the United States who were primarily Protestant, although there were many forms of Protestantism. And, of course, they all certainly were students of history. They knew what had happened in past generations, in past centuries, in past civilizations, in ancient Greece, and ancient Rome. They were a lot better educated than most of our college graduates today. In fact, almost all of our college graduates today, because most of our people are never allowed to understand the real history. I know when I graduated from the University of California, with my medical degree, but I took history, I took a minor in history, and most of the history I learned just wasn't true. However, these people felt were deeply religious people here in the United States. They were students of John Locke and of Montesquieu, who was a French philosopher, a man named Blackstone, who wrote the commentaries on the laws of England, which was really the basis of English law and American law, really, for about 100-150 years. And it was these ideas that went into the writing of the Declaration. But I'm going to let William Federer tell you about this most amazing document that is still revered by philosophers throughout the world to this very day. It's a shame that it isn't more esteemed here in the United States. William, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, Dr. Stan, great to be with you.
You pick up the story.
Well, as far as our Declaration goes, a little bit before that was the French and Indian War. Between 1754 and 1763, in Europe it was called the Seven Years' War, but it was the French, having made treaties with the Indians, fighting against the British colonists. Well, Britain won and decided to leave its troops over on American soil in case there was a future war, and wanted the Americans to pay for these troops. Well, the American attitude was we were pulled into a war that we had nothing to do with. This was an ancient animosity that France and England had, and we just happened to suffer as a result.
So hold that thought. We're going to be back here in just a moment here with William Federick. You go ahead, pick up the story.
And so the British began to quarter their troops in the homes of the Americans. Quartering means that the soldiers come up to your house, knock on the door, and say, we're going to live here. You find your own place in the attic or the basement or the barn. And by the way, you have to feed us. And obviously this didn't go over too well. So in 1770, there was the Boston Massacre, where a big mob did not like the quartering of the troops, and the British troops were in a confused situation and fired and killed five people. And then the king responded by punishing the colonies, passing all kinds of taxes. These were taxes that the colonists had to pay for these troops. So not only did we have these troops over here quartering in our houses, we had to pay for them. And so there's a 1764 Sugar Act, which taxed sugar and coffee and wine and so forth. The 1765 Stamp Act that taxed newspapers, contracts, letters, playing cards, and all printed materials had to have a stamp on it. The 1767 Townshend Act, which taxed glass and paints and papers and so forth. And then, of course, the 1773 Tea Tax. And the British tea companies did not have to pay taxes, but the American ones did. And so that's when we had the Boston Tea Party, and threw 342 chests of tea into the harbor there. And so the British decided to blockade the Boston Harbor in 1774 on June 1st. The next colony over was Virginia, and Thomas Jefferson, as a leader in the Virginia House of Burgesses, makes a proposal of a day of fasting and prayer for the colony of Virginia to go into effect when the king blockades the Massachusetts harbor. Well, the Continental Congress was started as a result of this. The royal governor of Massachusetts, I'm sorry, of Virginia, goes in to the House of Burgesses, and he feels like this proclamation of fasting and prayer that Jefferson submitted was a cloaked protest against the king's policies toward Massachusetts. So he disbands the House of Burgesses, and the legislators go down the street to Sir Walter Raleigh Tavern, and that's where they decide to have a Continental Congress shortly thereafter in Philadelphia. And then the British, not only did they blockade the Boston Harbor, but they took control of Boston, and that's when the Battle of Bunker Hill took place.
All right, you hold that thought, because I want all of our listeners to hear this story. I think we need to hear the story of America over and over again. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Of course, our guest, William Federer, is simply talking about the things that led up to the Declaration of Independence, and certainly the French and Indian War. The British were really fighting the French here. The French were using the Indians to get back at the British, and of course, the English wanted to keep their troops here, and they wanted the American people to actually pay to actually keep the British troops here. The Americans didn't want to do that, so the king ordered troops to start just going into homes and just taking over homes. People had to move out of their own homes, so the British troops could actually have their troops quartered in private homes, and then the private people had to feed them, and this caused tremendous resentment, and this led, of course, eventually to what was known as the Boston Massacre, and then a series of other events that culminated in the early 1770s with the Tea Party in Boston, and then, of course, in sympathy with the Tea Party in Boston and the subsequent blockade of the harbor of Boston by the British Navy. Why, suddenly they held they were going to hold a day of fasting and prayer in Virginia under the direct leadership of Thomas Jefferson, and the royal governor of Virginia, feeling that this was really a sign of support for the people in Massachusetts because they were blockading the port there in Boston, why the British governor of Virginia suspended the House of Burgesses, which was sort of like their local parliament, representative government. The people then disbanded, and they went down to the Sir Walter Raleigh Tavern, and they decided at that point that they were going to hold a Continental Congress, get representatives from all the states together to talk about the problem with the British rule and the fact that the British rule was oppressive and it was violating their rights as Englishmen. So you pick up the story there, Bill.
Well, there was the Battle of Bunker Hill, and that's when the British, with their thousands of troops, it's an interesting story. The British were going to pound away at Bunker Hill with their cannons, but since this was the first, more or less, battle of the war, the British general found out that the cannonballs were the wrong size for his cannons, and so the American colonists sort of lucked out. Nevertheless, the British charged up the hill, and the Americans waited until, you know, the don't shoot till you see the whites of their eyes. Americans waited and waited, and then when the British got right to the top, they fired. And British General Howe's men, 2,300 of them, fell back. And then the British charged again, and the Americans waited and waited, and then fired, and then the British fell back. And that happened a third time until the Americans ran out of gunpowder, and over 1,000 British were killed, nearly 500 Americans. But this was the first battle of the Revolutionary War. 300 miles away in Philadelphia at this time was when the Continental Congress drafted George Washington as commander-in-chief. George Washington took command of the Continental Army in 1775. Matter of fact, he writes to his wife, Martha. He says, "Dearest, it has been determined in Congress that the whole army raised for the defense of the American cause shall be put under my care, and that it is necessary for me to proceed at once to Boston to take command. I shall rely, therefore, confidently on that providence which has hitherto preserved and been bountiful to me." And he ends it by saying, "I got Colonel Pendleton to draft a will. The provision made for you in case of my death will, I hope, be agreeable." Anyway, so Washington takes command of the army there in Boston, and he sends 26-year-old Henry Knox up to Fort Ticonderoga, and he gathers the cannons out of that old French fort, and they drag them through the wintertime on sleds across lakes and rivers to get them down to Boston. Matter of fact, one of them, of the cannons, breaks through the ice, and they have to fish it out in the freezing cold. And when they get to Boston, Washington has straw put on the wheels of the wagons that are hauling the cannons up to Dorchester Heights so that the British wouldn't get a clue. They wouldn't hear the clanking of the cannons. And then the next day, the British wake up and see these cannons on this high hill within range of their ships staring down at them. And so the British decide to evacuate Boston. So this was the first major victory for the colonists. Washington then goes down to New York, and the British decide they're going to attack there next. Well, that's when the Declaration of Independence was written and signed. This was in July of 1776. They voted for independence on July 2nd. On July 4th is when two people signed the Declaration. John Hancock, the president of the Continental Congress from Massachusetts. And, of course, John Hancock signed very large, and he said, "Now the King of England can read my signature without using his spectacles, his glasses." And he said, "The price on my head is just doubled." And that's what gave birth to that saying, "Put your John Hancock here." And then Charles Thompson was the Secretary of the Continental Congress. The rest of them didn't start signing until August 2nd. That's when an engrossed parchment copy had been prepared, and about two-thirds signed it. But the rest had to come back to Philadelphia. They had left in that month's time to go back and fight a war. They couldn't just hang around waiting to sign something. And so it took about 6 months for them to come back. And finally, January of 1777 is when the last one signed it. And anyway, but on July 8th is when it was read out loud for the first time. That's when they rang the Liberty Bell. July 9th is when they finally got a copy out to George Washington there in New York City. Washington had the Declaration read to his troops. And the very next order is Washington ordered chaplains appointed to every regiment And he says that to the highest glory of patriot, we should add the higher glory of Christian. And he says the duty of all Christian soldiers to defend our country and so on and so forth. Anyway, Washington had 20,000 volunteers in July of 1776. Then the British began to show up and bring the ships into New York Harbor. And 10, 20, 30, 100, 200, 300, 400 ships. They said it was like a forest of trees, the mass of these ships just filled the harbor. And then they decided to start pounding away with their cannons. Deafening, deafening roars. And Washington's men, who had spent months building defense works, freaked and began to run. And the British troops began unloading, and Washington gets in front of his fleeing men and tries to order them to stop their retreat, and they keep running, and the British are advancing, and they're only about 50 yards away when one of Washington's aides grabs the reins of his horse and pulls him off the battlefield. Well, Washington's so upset, but yet these men retreat all the way across Manhattan Island, and then they begin to retreat across New York, and he wins a little skirmish here or there, but the British control the waterways, and so Washington retreated all the way across New Jersey. And you read the stories of the British going to the farmhouses of any loyalist and raping the women and the daughters while the men are being, you know, held back. And, I mean, just horrible stuff that happens in, you know, other terrible warfares. Well, it happened here. And one of the signers of the Declaration was Richard Stockton. He had been a popular man in New Jersey, the Supreme Court Justice. But he had a neighbor betray him. The King of England offered amnesty to anybody that would return to loyalty to the king. And so one of Richard Stockton's neighbors led the British to where he was hiding and fleeing with his family. And Richard Stockton was thrown in prison, starved in the freezing cold. His farm was destroyed. His library, which was one of the biggest in America, was destroyed. Everything he had was vandalized. All of his money he had, you know, put into paper continental currency, and it was made worthless. He died a beggar at the age of 51 in 1781, right before the war ended. And so when he put his name on that declaration, it cost him. Now, we all know Richard Stockton because his son Robert was a hero of the War of 1812, and Robert Stockton was the first governor of California. So Stockton, California is named after Robert Stockton, whose father was Richard Stockton, that was the signer of the Declaration from New Jersey that, that died at 51 bankrupt because he put his name on that document. Another one of the signers was John Hart. He was from New Jersey. He was chased from his wife's dying bedside. He was 60 years old. He was forced to live in caves and in the woods, not two nights in the same place. His farm was destroyed. All his kids were scattered, and he died shortly thereafter. He didn't see the end of the war. 17 of the founders lost their fortunes, amongst them being Carter Braxton. Then you read about 11 had their homes destroyed, one of them being Thomas Nelson. Remember the Battle of Yorktown? It was portrayed fairly well in Mel Gibson's movie The Patriot. The very last battle of that movie shows the Americans pounding away at Cornwallis, who's taken up his headquarters in this big mansion that's being blown to pieces. Well, that mansion happened to be Thomas Nelson's. He was never reimbursed. There was never any stimulus package to bail him out, and he died bankrupt. And many of them, five became prisoners of war. One, Abraham Clark from New Jersey, he had two sons imprisoned on the British starving ship Jersey. Now, it's important to understand that the difference between Americans' treatment of prisoners and the British. When George Washington had captured those 1,000 German Hessian troops at Trenton, he marched them back over the Delaware River into Pennsylvania, and upon their promise not to raise arms against America again, he let them go. Well, the British, on the other hand, turned churches into prisons and schoolhouses into prisons and boats into prisons, the starving ships, the New York Harbor, and more Americans died on the British starving ships, 13,000 of them, than died in battle with the British, 4,000. And anyway, Abraham Clark's two sons were put on one of those starving ships.
Well, we'll be back here in just a moment, but people really don't understand the sacrifices that were made to bring about America, the wonderful country that we've enjoyed for so long. It's a shame it's been taken over by people who don't believe in America, who have a different worldview, who really want to create a world government. Well, William, you go right ahead.
Well, thanks, Dr. Sand. Of course, all this is in my books. AmericanMinute.com is my website, but all my different books have this stuff. One of the signers of the Declaration of Independence was a minister.
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a 4-tape or a 4-CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer Iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets, a little protects your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances, even things which can cause sickness or disease? If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Verkey water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Verkey water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-730-9796.
Their fortunes, but none of them ever renounced their dedication to this idea of establishing a nation where men could be free. Well, of course, the war that followed was a long and bloody war, and Sidney Williams telling us some of the stories about the terrible, terrible things that happened. And certainly, we were a divided nation. Many of the people were loyalists. They wanted to support the king. A lot of people didn't care one way or the other. They just wanted to be left alone. And then there were the patriots who really wanted to be free, wanted to break loose from the tyranny of having a king and the Hessian troops over here imposing the king's will on the people. And, of course, simply William has pointed out how ruthless the British were, to anyone who opposed them. It's so reminiscent of the way America is now. At one time, America was a noble and moral nation, and now we justify torturing. Well, we have to torture people, after all. We didn't torture a lot of people. Why, we wouldn't know if somebody wanted to really hated us and who was our enemy. And how can a moral nation support torture many times of innocent people, torturing them to death? And there are dozens of people who've been tortured to death in the last few years by American forces, but we can't criticize the people who do it. They were carrying out orders. We can't criticize the people who, said they did the torturing or gave the orders to torture, because they were simply carrying out the policies laid out by the lawyers, and we can't criticize the lawyers because it was just their opinion. Maybe they didn't have anything to do with the consequences of their opinions. And where is the outcry from the religious leaders of America? Have you ever heard of a religious leader of America criticizing the policy of torture used by America? Well, years ago, we were well justified in certainly criticizing the torture carried out by the British at the time of the American Revolution. William, pick up the story.
Jane McCrae's scalp was cut off and she was killed and the Indians came back into the camp, there was an outcry. And so the general had to go to the Indians and try to talk them into calming down a little bit and not being so ruthless. Well, the Indians only knew on and off. They were either at peace or at war. They didn't know any of this politically correct warfare type stuff. And so they got offended and left. And they left Burgoyne and his thousands of troops in the middle of the New York forest blind. I mean, the Indians were their scouts. They were everything. And so now Burgoyne was just stuck. And so that gave the Americans the advantage, and the Americans won the Battle of Saratoga. A very important battle. Benedict Arnold was one of the heroes of that. Of course, he later tried to betray the country. But nevertheless, we won the Battle of Saratoga, and we began winning war after war, battle after battle, but a lot of them were ones that were miraculous, were ones that Washington realized that he had a very limited amount of troops, and so it was a lot of the guerrilla warfare. But it's interesting when you read the Declaration and see some of the things that were written in there. Of course, the first thing I think it is worth reiterating, the idea. Now, the Declaration of Independence does mention God four times, laws of nature and of nature's God. And then it says that all men are endowed by their creator with certain naval rights, and then appealing to the supreme judge of the world and with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence. But that phrase in there, that all men are created equal, that is a revolutionary concept. For most of world history, if you were friends with the king, you were more equal, and if you were not friends with the king, you were less equal. Sort of like hate crime legislation. If you hold to the agenda that the president has and embrace homosexuality, well, then you are more equal. But if you believe in traditional Judeo-Christian values, then you are less equal. And then you look at Islam. There is no such thing as equality in Islam. Allah loves the Muslim who has submitted, and Allah hates the infidel. They actually have two sets of laws in Sharia Islam. One is for the Muslim, and the other is for the Dhimmi, or the Zimmi, which is the non-Muslim, the Jew and the Christian. And a Jew or a Christian have absolutely no legal standing in court against a Muslim. Then they have a whole other category for women, that women are half of a worth of a man. It takes two women to testify in court against one man. A woman gets half the inheritance that a man does. And so there is no such thing as equality in Islam. So when our declaration says all men are created equal, that is a Judeo-Christian concept. It didn't come from Hinduism, because in Hinduism, if you're in the lowest caste as an untouchable, you're considered less than human. You have to clean the toilets, live outside of town, take care of the garbage. The other caste won't even touch you. You're not equal to the Brahmin. In Hinduism, a Brahmin is near divinity. And then in atheism, your worth is dependent on your utility. If you can contribute to the state, you're worth more. If you're
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly our guest this evening is William Federer, and of course William's been a frequent guest on our program through the years. Wonderful, wonderful stories he has, and we carry so many of his books, certainly on George Washington Carver. We carry his books on Santa Claus and St. Patrick, and his book America's God and Country. And well, you can go to our website and certainly get a list of his books. But we'll be back here in just a moment with William Federer. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is William Federer. And William, would you like to tell our listeners your website so they could go there and get the American Minute?
Sure. It's AmericanMinute.com, and you can sign up and get a free daily email. Or just go to your website, Dr. Stan. They can order any of my books there. But it's just important for us to remember what caused this country to be great so we can keep it that way.
Amen to that. And of course, it was really, as laid out in the Declaration of Independence, the concept that there was a God. They spoke of nature's God and nature's law. And then they talked about the Creator. Then they talked about the supreme ruler of the world and, of course, of divine providence. But, of course, they took God out of our schools very intentionally because they realized if they could destroy the religious beliefs of our people, why, they could destroy this nation. And when I say they, who am I talking about? Why, I'm talking about the Masonic Supreme Court justices who control the Supreme Court, majorities of 5-4 to 8-1 for a 30-year period. between 1941 and 1971. You can verify this on the Internet, or we can send some material on that if you'd like. But you must understand, no one will tell you that. Why? Because the Masons are simply part of an occult brotherhood. There are many organizations, secret or semi-secret or covert organizations, all bound together by worship of a different God. And until people understand that, why, so very little of what's going on today really makes sense, or the true nature of the spiritual battle that is being waged makes any sense. William, you pick up the story.
Well, the Declaration does list some of the other reasons in which we were rebelling. It says, we have petitioned for redress. In the most humble terms, our repeated petitions have only been answered by repeated injuries, sort of like the Boston Tea Parties. This is an interesting one. For taxation without our consent, for imposing taxes on us without our consent. That was listed as one of the reasons. So you just asked your friends there, did they consent to all the taxes they're being taxed with? If they haven't, well, then they're in the same line here. And here's an interesting one. He has erected a multitude of new offices and sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance. He has erected a multitude of new offices. Gee, that sort of sounds like the czars. He's 21 different czars. These are new offices. They've been multiplied. And they're completely dependent on the king. The president. And then it goes on to say...
Let me just comment, that the Romanovs didn't have anywhere near as many czars ruling Russia as Obama has ruling in the United States. Where does the president of the United States get off appointing the CEO, the new CEO of General Motors? Where does the president of the United States get off having people tell banks how much money that they can pay their executives and how much bonuses they can pay their executives and putting pressure on the major banks to accept the TARP funds? We did a program earlier today with somebody who actually got the talking points from the Secretary of Treasury, where Henry Paulson actually got together the CEOs of the 9 major banks, locked the door, and literally threatened them that they would be exposed and destroyed if they refused to take the funds that Henry Paulson said that they needed. And, of course, those funds would then give the government control over the 9 major banks. And Judicial Watch has all of this information. And now we see the government beginning to put pressure on corporations to knuckle under. If there was really a financial crisis, there was no money to lend, then why did the banks not want to get the money from the government? They didn't want the money. They were forced to take it. And we see the same pattern that we saw there under the British monarchy being played out in America today. And the average individual sort of shrugs and wonders, of course, how soon football is going to begin. But go right ahead.
Yeah, so he has erected a multitude of new offices. Then he says he has made judges dependent on his will alone. And so it's very much like... appointing somebody to the Supreme Court that has the president's agenda. And so if you are a loyalist and you went before one of these judges, well, you got really good treatment. If you were a patriot and you went before one of these king's judges, guess what? You got the book thrown at you. So it's sort of like hate crime legislation. If you believe the way the king did and you go before a king's appointed judge, you'll get favoritism. But if you're a traditional value person and you go before one of these politically correct judges. Matter of fact, it talked about this in the Declaration. It talks about how the king has left his armies on our troops, and he says that he has protected them by mock trials from punishments, so these troops could be on American soil and they don't get judged by the laws. The founders, 56 men, signed this Declaration. They did pay a price. I like to point out, our founders sacrificed their prosperity for their posterity. They pledged their lives and their fortunes and their sacred honor for a generation yet unknown. That's why in the Constitution it says, for ourselves and our posterity. So they were thinking about their posterity. they form a new government. So the founders sacrificed their prosperity for their posterity. Today we're sacrificing our posterity for prosperity. We're saddling our kids and grandkids and great-grandkids with the world's greatest debt so that we can have some temporary, financial cushion here. And so the average child, as soon as they're born into the world, they have $500,000 debt from President Obama that they're going to spend the rest of their life trying to dig out of. And so this is something that our founders did not want. And even Thomas Jefferson talked about how he was able to make large payments on the national debt and free our posterity from that mortal canker of debt, of public debt. And so one of the things I point out is there's been 5,000 years of recorded human history. That's all, just 5,000 years. That's 50 people living 100 years each, back to back, and you're all the way back to Egyptian hieroglyphics and Sumerian cuneiform on clay tablets. I mean, you get any world history book, and it only goes back to 3,000 B.C., and we're 2,000 A.D., so that's 5,000 years of recorded human history. Evolution tries to say man's been around for gazillions of years, but as far as actual human records, writing down, documents, it goes back 5,000. Anyway, during that time, empires have risen and empires have fallen, and empires have risen and empires have fallen. The Sumerian Empire, the Egyptian Empire, the Babylonian Empire, Alexander the Great's Empire, the Roman Empire, Attila the Hun, the Vikings, the Byzantine Empire, the Muslim, Muhammad's Empire. I mean, Muhammad died in 632 A.D. in Arabia, and within 100 years of his death, the Muslims conquered the Holy Land, all of Egypt, which used to be Christian, all of North Africa. There used to be 250 Catholic dioceses along North Africa. All of Spain, they conquered Spain in 10 years, and they crossed the Pyrenees Mountains, and they came within 170 miles of Paris before they were stopped at the Battle of Tours in 732 A.D., exactly 100 years after the death of Muhammad in 632 A.D. Anyway, then after, Muhammad's empire was stopped, there was the Frankish Empire, Charlemagne there in Europe, and then the Byzantine Empire fell to the Muslims when they were invading, and then there was the Austro-Hungarian Empire in Europe, and once Constantinople fell to the Muslims is when Spain sent Columbus to find another way to India and China, and so then there was a Spanish Empire, which circled the world, the Caribbean, and they claimed North America, and of course, part South America. I mean, Spain was huge. But it's sort of funny that none of these empires in their height ever imagined that they would cease to be the world empire. They're sort of like this fog that descends on these empires where they, in their prime, they think, oh, we're always going to be like this, not realizing that the day will come when they're no longer going to be center stage. And, Mongolia, for a while, Mongolia under Genghis Khan had the largest contiguous land empire in world history. The Mongolian Empire went from Korea to Hungary and from Moscow down to India. But what's Mongolia today? You can't even find it on a map, but for most people, empires sort of go the route of an athlete. When they're young, they're focused and disciplined, and they feel like they're the best, and they want to take over. And then they get to be the best, and they rule the world, and they're like the major world influence. But then what happens is they get to be a couch potato. They don't exercise. They lose that discipline. They lose that focus, identity as a people. And then the next civilization challenges them into the boxing ring. And in their mind, they still think they're that great nation, and their military's the best. But now they're a 50-year-old potbelly, that's been doing drugs and sex and all kinds of stuff, and they get the tar knocked out of them. And then the next civilization takes over ruling the world for a while, and then until they get fat and sassy and top-heavy with taxes and debt and so forth and overstretched borders. And so, if I were to pick a time when America was at its peak, its prime, I'd probably say from Teddy Roosevelt to Franklin Roosevelt. I mean, after Franklin Roosevelt, we got into the Korean War, and then surrendering a little bit of our sovereignty to the UN, and then we get to the 60s with the drug culture and the free sex, and now we're teaching in schools that America's the problem with the world. We're graduating kids to think, why defend America? Aren't we the problem? And so we've lost that, it's one of the things in history where the conquered nation always learns the language of the conqueror. You know, I mean, when Napoleon had conquered, he'd spread the French language. That's where we get the word lingua francese, which means the international language, you know. And Alexander the Great spread the Greek language. Well, you know, here in America, we're now having to punch one if you want it in English and punch two in Spanish. In other words, we've sort of peaked, you know, and from a spiritual sense, you know, Deuteronomy 28 says, these are the blessings if you follow the Lord, you'll lend to many nations and not borrow. And it says, these are the curses if you don't follow the Lord, you'll be a debtor to all the nations. Well, we just happen to be the most in-debt nation in world history. But anyway, during this 5,000 years, these empires that have risen and fallen, the government structure has almost always been monarchs, despots, tyrants, Caesars, pharaohs, sultans, czars, visors, kaisers, and these leaders had concentrated power. Well, America, we tried something different. We, because of our 3,000-mile ocean between us and our monarch, the King of England, we got to experiment with self-governing power. We got to take the powers of a monarch and split them into three branches and separate it from the federal to the state level and tie them up with 10 handcuffs we call the First 10 Amendments. In other words, in America, we made the people the king and the politicians the servants. I mean, what a switch. And our founders actually designed a system of government to work inefficiently on purpose. It was slow to making good decisions, but thank God it was slow to making bad decisions. The most efficient form of government is a monarchy. One person says it, it happens, or heads roll. And our founders experienced how you could be really good friends with one king, he'd die, and the next day another one would take over, and he'd have you hanging from the gallows. Or like in Henry VIII's case, you know, I mean, here he was Catholic, and then he decided to want another wife. The Pope wouldn't recognize his divorce, so he said, okay, I'm going to be my own Pope, and he told everybody in England, if you don't acknowledge me, you're dead. So Sir Thomas More, this little guy that was really loyal to the king, said, I can't change. Well, he gets killed. Well, then Henry VIII dies, and Edward serves for a couple years, but he died at 14. But then next was Mary, Henry VIII's daughter. She wanted to make England Catholic again, so she killed 300 Protestants, and she's called Bloody Mary. Well, then her half-sister Elizabeth took over, and she killed some Catholics, like Mary Queen of Scots. But Mary Queen of Scots' son was James the First, and he started killing the Puritans because the Puritans were, you know, and so it goes on and on. And so the founders in America didn't like that fast change. In other words, they thought change was bad. They wanted to design a system of government that changed slowly. And so they put all these, you know, two different houses and federal to state level and 10 handcuffs and three branches of government. They tried to make it very hard and difficult to make changes. And as a result, America has had the longest lasting free government in world history. But the problem is, after every crisis, we see a gradual reconcentration of power. So it was great that Lincoln ended slavery, but in the process, he concentrated a lot of power in the federal government. It was great that Woodrow Wilson got us through World War I, but in the process, he concentrated a lot of power in the federal government with the Federal Reserve and the income tax. Franklin Roosevelt got us through the Depression and World War II, but he concentrated a lot of power in the federal government with his New Deal programs. And Lyndon Johnson concentrated power with his Great Society socialist programs, and even President Bush concentrated power with his War on Terror and Patriot Act stuff. And now all that concentrated power has been handed over to our new president, and he's put it on steroids. And he's been concentrating power faster and at an exponential rate more than any of the others. And we're basically going back to the monarch situation. And I speak in schools, and I'll have the kids hold up a fist in one hand and say concentrated power. And then I have them hold up an open palm with their fingers separated on the other hand and say separated power. And then I said, now go back to the fist again. We've gone from the concentrated powers of the king, where the king of England was the king of the country, the commander of their military, and the head of their church. And we went from that to the separated powers. But again, after every crisis, we've seen a reconcentration. Now, I thought it was interesting to compare philosophers. The founding fathers were really into philosophers that separated power, like Montesquieu, this French philosopher. That he basically came up with the three branches of government and so forth. And James Madison. Madison said, all men having power ought to be distrusted. And then there was the British Lord Acton that said power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. But there were other philosophers that wanted to concentrate power. One of them was a guy named Machiavelli. He lived 500 years ago in Italy. And Italy wasn't Italy. Italy was a bunch of little kingdoms, and they were always fighting each other, Siena and Genoa and Venice. Machiavelli said, you know, if one prince could control all of Italy, it'll stop all this infighting. So Machiavelli wrote a book called The Prince for a rich guy in Florence named Lorenzo de' Medici. And in this book, Machiavelli says the ends justifies the means. In other words, if this prince wanted to conquer a city and the people didn't want him to conquer them, well, if he conquers it, the people will hate him. But if the prince pays somebody to burn barns, kill cows, create terror, the people will cry out for help. And the prince will come in and kill the guy that he paid, and nobody will know the better for it, and all the people will treat the prince as a hero.
In other words, what you want is an enemy, something to that the people will be fearful of, and then you can rally the people behind the government. Is that sort of how it works?
Right. It's good marketing. You create the need and fill it. You go on the back of the house and set it on fire, then you go around the front of the house and sell them a fire extinguisher. Now, this is called Machiavellianism. If you get a Funkin' Wagnalls encyclopedia, it defines Machiavellianism as the graduated use of crisis and terror to consolidate power. And that's why when Rahm Emanuel, the president's chief of staff, said never let a good crisis go to waste, here's somebody that understands this Machiavellian idea that crises need to take place for people to relinquish their rights and freedom.
Hold that thought. Okay, you go right ahead. We have 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Well, one other philosopher that concentrated power was named Hegel, George Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel. He lived in Germany in the early 1800s.
Heart disease is on the rise. Clogged arteries, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol levels may not be fully detected by you, but the symptoms are there. Loss of energy, blood sugar spikes and drops, poor circulation, and irregular heartbeat are just a few of these that can alert you that something is wrong. Hear how Heart and Body Extract is making a difference in thousands of people's lives across America.
My blood pressure has normalized. My diabetes has totally improved.
Everyone is telling me now how much healthier I look. And I'm telling everyone how much healthier I feel. I recommend Heart and Body Extract to everyone.
Anybody over 40 in the North American continent should be using this product as a preventative to keep their cardiovascular system healthy.
Order your 2-month supply today by calling 866-295-5305. That's 866-295-5305. Or order online, hbextract.com. Heart and Body Extract, 866-295-5305 or hbextract.com.
In these times of falling values, high unemployment, loss of income, and with hyperinflation on its way, we have created a 1-ounce silver coin with a cross and the words of John 3:16 on one side and the American Eagle on the other. These coins are mural finished, 0.999 silver. Each of these beautiful coins will always have an earthly store of value plus the cross with John 3:16 as an eternal value. Go to www.john316coin.com and call 1-877-316-COIN while supplies last. Order these beautiful 1-ounce John 316 American Eagle coins today by going to john316coin.com and calling 1-877-316-COIN.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll-free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-7...
getting that book so we can have it available. If you'd like to get Bill's books, they're wonderful books, wonderful moral lessons in them. If you'd like to give Chris a list, give us a call of 1-800-544-8927. We'll send you a list of all we carry, and we carry all of Bill's books. Bill, thanks very much for being with us. God bless.
Thank you, Dr. Stan. God bless you.
Bye-bye. And, Chris, we always enjoy having William Federer as a guest here at Radio Liberty. Now, you want to see how they've actually created the enemies. They created and financed communism from its inception. If you haven't read the book, Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, you need to get it. If you would like to get into the background of how we created Fidel Castro, you need to get my DVD entitled World Revolution, which contains an interview, my personal interview with the Ambassador Earl T. Smith, and of course Earl was the American ambassador to Cuba at the time of the revolution. He will tell you that we brought Fidel Castro to power, and we knew he was a communist, and he knew he was a communist, and the president knew he was a communist, and the State Department knew Fidel Castro was a communist. The DVD is World Revolution. We brought the Chinese communist to power. Of course, if you haven't got a little pamphlet on the communist-capitalist alliance, the phrase actually came from a speech that was given by Solzhenitsyn before the American Federation of Labor, of course, totally suppressed by the mass media. But, of course, we quote extensively from Solzhenitsyn's speech in that pamphlet and other material on how we financed communism during the Vietnam War. After all, we were supposedly over there fighting communism, weren't we? No, we were fighting. We were financing the communists. The Vietnam War was fought as a diversion so they could justify centralizing power in Washington, D.C. How can I make that statement? Well, I didn't make the statement. Big George Bundy, member of the Skull and Bones Council on Foreign Relations, National Security Advisor at the time we got into Vietnam, he made that statement in essence in an article called The End of Either Or, published by in the Foreign Affairs magazine, the official journal of the Council on Foreign Relations, which at that time was the invisible government of the United States, has been replaced by the Trilateral Commission for the Council on Foreign Relations. McGeorge Bundy basically in an article, January 1967, End of Either Or, we'll be glad to send you the pages, where he lays it all out. You know, it would be an act of folly for any true liberal to say we have a choice between guns and butter in Vietnam, because exactly the opposite is the case. If we were to pull out from Vietnam, there'd be tremendous reaction against our domestic programs, which was to bring about a socialist America and the great society of Lyndon Johnson. Well, there's so much information you're not going to get out there. This is why you need to get the material from Radio Liberty. Go to our website at radioliberty.com. You need my talk on the Brotherhood of Darkness, certainly that's available on DVD, or you can get the book. You need my talk on the Forbidden Secret to understand the spiritual forces behind what's going on, and there's a syllabus that goes with that. If you want to understand how they created this financial crisis so they could justify creating a world monetary system and force all nations of the world to go into the world government, which will be ruled by the Antichrist down the line, why, of course, the talk is the financial Armageddon. Tells you a great deal about Barack Obama, what the people from the occult side, the people who worship Lucifer, will say about Barack Obama. And that's it's called the financial Armageddon. We simply quote from their publications, not what I say, what they say. Financial Armageddon, and the syllabus goes with that, important parts of your armamentarium to understand what in heaven's name is going on today, because it's not in heaven's name. The name, what's going on today, it represents the other side, the other force. Our number, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage, RadioLiberty.com. Please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views. I just didn't want to comment that during the last hour we talked about the fact that the people had been tortured to death in American custody. And I think I used the phrase hundreds. Apparently about 100, over 100 people have died while they were in custody, American custody, in Iraq, and many of them, of course, died during the interrogations. We do not know how many, but over 100 had died when they were in custody, and certainly under. We know that some of them were frankly tortured to death by over-enthusiastic people, just doing what they were instructed and what they were ordered to do by their superiors, who were just doing what they were told to do by the Bush administration, who justifies what they did because the lawyers said it was perfectly all right. And we can't be critical of the lawyers because, after all, it was just their opinion, and so nobody's responsible for torturing people to death. Well, that is the background. Well, our special guest for this next hour is going to be Bob Fletcher. And Bob has, of course, done a lot of investigative reporting. He actually makes videos. I do talk radio. Bob makes videos, excellent videos, and I think we carry just about all of them. How are you doing tonight, Bob?
Okay, and I'm pleased to be here.
All right, fine. Well, what are we going to talk about tonight? We're going to talk a little bit about the strange death of Sonny Bono, and then we can talk about really whatever you want to talk about. But Bob has done a great deal of investigation. He knew Sonny. He actually had sent a report, one of his reports, to Sonny Bono, who was going to actually to open an investigation as soon as he got back from the ski trip, but he never got back. You pick up the story, Bob.
Well, you know, it's amazing today watching, of course, all of the attention that Michael Jackson, the performer, has gotten with his death. And it was a surprising, surprise death, 50 years old. We'll have to wait and see what turns up to be the real reason for his death. And maybe it was just a simple cardiac, or maybe it was more than that. Maybe it was something else. But what struck me personally is, and I had been in the music business the earlier part of my life. At a rather high level, I was a promotion director for MCA and Universal Motion Pictures, and had been involved at the very high professional level and executive management in the record and music business. So I had a special feeling towards any of the performers that were really great. And of course, this Michael Jackson was, so whether a person likes him you know, or thought much of his personal life, and which, of course, I know nothing about, and most all of us don't. But whether you liked him or not, he certainly was an extraordinary entertainer. And but it bothered me to see the amount of attention given to his death. And, of course, there's the DEA, Drug Enforcement, is involved in it now, and the FBI, and, of course, the local police in, have gotten profusely involved with the investigation and looking into his death. And I had done a special report for Congressman Sonny Bono and a few years back, and had put it in his hands. As a matter of fact, it was at the request of his office. I carried out this special investigation, which was a very in-depth investigation into drug smuggling and murder and other related interfacing with the money laundering connected to it, etc.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, Bob, go ahead. You were just saying, of course, that you'd done these investigations and into drug smuggling and murder, and, of course, there was a question of some even CIA involvement in this, and so you'd carried out this investigation for Congressman Sonny Bono, and you'd actually given him a copy of your ultimate video and report. So go ahead.
Right, and the report, the final report, was done on video, and it was specific reason for that, and that was that I had the extraordinary inclusive part of it, extraordinary parts of it was that I actually had major drug warlords and drug smugglers themselves and high-level cartel persons, the bookkeeper for the Medellin cartel, the an interview done by a friend of mine on the hill in Burma by the Burmese drug lord Khun Sa, who had come forward and had actually named the names of people in the United States government at extremely high levels, which included at that time a person who was the Assistant Secretary of State for the United States of America. His name was Richard Armitage. He was named specifically by Khun Sa, the drug exporter, one of the biggest drug exporters in the entire world. And this was all done on live videotape for the report I did to Sonny. So when Sonny finally got to review it and go into it in depth, he actually had it for a few months before they got back to me. And when his office got back to me, I was living in Los Angeles at the time. They called me, and they said Sonny was livid, that he couldn't believe the extent of high-level involvement in narcotics, and it was just making him crazy, and that he was going to begin within only a couple of weeks. He was going to open up an extraordinary, in-depth investigation by the Congressional Intelligence Committee, and they had already set up in advance the ability to have subpoena powers. They were going to be able to subpoena people directly and bring them to the floor of the United States Congress before the Intelligence Committee, and they were going to finally do an investigation that should have been done years earlier. Myself and other persons had tried several times and attempted to get a that level.
Hold that thought, or we'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Bob has just been commenting on the drama surrounding the tragic death of Michael Jackson. Certainly an excellent entertainer, but almost a hero's death, unfortunately, probably related to overuse of drugs. Everything points in that direction, but certainly contrast that then with the death of Congressman Sonny Bono. And of course, Bob had been working with Congressman Bono. He had actually prepared a report for him, and Congressman Bono was going to actually hold congressional hearings going into the involvement of the CIA and key people in the government in the drug trade. And certainly there was some footage in this report, which we actually carry by Bob Pleasure on drugs, going into the fact that the one of the major people behind the drug trade in the United States, according to a man named Kun Saw, who headed the Golden Triangle area there in Burma, was Richard Armitage. Now, I'm sure that nothing was mentioned, the fact that Richard Armitage is part of the ruling elite, at the time when he was identified being in charge of the buying of the drugs there and from Burma. Why, of course, he was working in the White House. Today, he's a member of the Trilateral Commission, has been a member for many years. But Sonny Bono was going to investigate all of this. He had the ability to subpoena people and call them to come before Congress to testify. And so pick up the story there, Bob.
And so the finally, Sonny did go over it and over the report and decided to move forward. This would have been, without a doubt, not only the biggest thing that Sonny had ever done in his political career, which, by the way, had started to be very, very positive. He was doing some good work, and he had been well respected up on the Hill. People originally, of course, it was a little bit of a joke when he first went up there, but they had turned their heads around in the right direction, and he was doing a very good job. He was had decided to move forward with this investigation. Now, I had received my phone call approximately sometime around, I believe, about the 21st or the 15th of December, something like that. And the telephone call was from a fellow named Frank Cullen, who was actually running Sonny's offices for him, pretty much the main character there at the Washington, D.C. offices for Sonny. And he said, Bob, this is the first thing on this calendar when we come back from the Christmas holidays, which he said we're about to take off here in a couple of days. We'll be gone for a few weeks, 2 weeks or something like that. It's a typical Christmas holiday for the United States Congress. And the first thing when we get back is going to be the investigation. Sonny's ready to go, and nothing's going to stop him, and we're going to be underway. He asked me if I was ready to come into Washington, if necessary, myself, and could I supply them with any additional information and backup on the rest of my report. I said, absolutely. I was ready to do it. I was enthused. I was very excited. And the idea of an extraordinarily serious inquiry into major persons in our government, by the way, both Republican and Democratic, had nothing to do with parties. They spanned both parties, and both parties at the highest level had been involved with money laundering, drug smuggling, and murders, assassinations, and was all interfaced together. And there was, again, as I say, live on our report, which I did for Sonny, there are statements by very high-level drug operatives themselves that explain who they worked for and how and what they were doing. So we hung up the telephone. I was overwhelmed with the idea that we were going to move forward in such a grandiose manner. And son of a gun, 10 days later, I, like everyone else, sitting in front of my television, and Sonny Bono was dead on the ski slopes. And, of course, they told us that he had run into the tree. And, of course, with myself, my very first thought was, this, I mean, what kind of a coincidence was this? This is so extraordinary, and very few people die from running into trees on a ski slope. You actually, according to official records, you can die more easily by, or more likely that you will die by being struck by lightning in the United States than dying on a ski slope. I immediately called Frank Cullen, the person with whom I was dealing on a regular basis in Sonny's office, and to my maybe surprise and maybe not surprise, he would never take my phone call. This was a gentleman with whom I had worked for a couple of years, and on a regular basis, if I was into Washington for some reason or another, I would stop by, even if it wasn't to see him, but I would stop in and would look him up, and we'd have a cup of coffee or lunch or something together, and all of a sudden now he will no longer take my telephone call, and that was as of 3 days after Sonny's death. So instantly, my concerns with the fact that Sonny maybe had been stopped before doing his investigation became very serious. I started looking into things. I did the best I could. And I kept running into more and more hurdles that I had to jump and being stopped by every possible direction when I got into investigating. I did finally, without getting into the whole thing, which of course is available on a new a DVD that we've put out recently. Matter of fact, both the report that I gave to Sonny and the new report on Sonny's murder is available for anybody that's interested. But to get back to the story itself, as I got looking into it, and I actually finally was able to get a hold of the autopsy. And this is one of the reasons that really had pushed me in the direction to spend so much time and effort on this thing. And that was the fact that the autopsy was being very secretive. They were not releasing it even to Sonny's own mother. She had a heck of a time getting a copy of the autopsy. And I ended up working with his Sonny's mother's attorney, and with her assistance and others that were involved with it, I did finally get the autopsy. And when I went over the autopsy, I was open to the fact. I said, "Okay, I'm going to go over this with a clear mind and see if, in fact, this is obviously an accident, and he did run into a tree. Well, then it was just an act of God, and I would stand down." But what happened was just the opposite. When I got into the autopsy, on the very first page, there was bits and pieces that didn't fit. And then it was like second page, third page, fourth, fifth, sixth. And as we went through the autopsy, it was every single page of the autopsy did not fit into the idea that Sonny simply lost his way and smacked a tree. And I'm absolutely positive, after completing my secondary report and investigation on Sonny's death, that he was, in fact, murdered to stop that major inquiry that he was about to begin in the United States Congress. And it's just one piece right after another when you go over it all, and we were able to get the actual live footage up on the ski slope taken of the where he had had his theoretically had had his accident, and that even shows to be almost an impossibility that he could have run into the tree in the manner that they showed. Then there was all sorts of small bits and pieces, like a tremendous amount of blood on the back of his coat and his jacket and his clothing, a huge amount of blood that soaked through all three layers of clothing on the back, and there was no injury to his back. So that meant the blood, that extreme amount of blood, came from someone else. And I believe it came from one of possibly two people that had accosted and grabbed Sonny and had struck him. I'm positive the laboratory test that we carried out indicates that he was probably killed, I'm almost positive, by being pistol-whipped in the head by a person who was left-handed, facing him straight on, and someone else holding and grappling and holding him with in the back, and probably got a bloody nose sufficiently to make that extraordinary strange amount of blood on the back of Sonny's jacket. And then it goes on and on. My report shows many, many specifics that would just completely prove the case that Sonny was murdered. Now, and of course, the timing, that speaks for itself. It was extraordinary bad coincidence if, in fact, he was only another 4 or 5 days he was going to be returning and beginning the investigation into drug smuggling and money laundering at the high level of our own government. Sonny had been involved with chasing other similar situations in terms of investigating drugs, and this was the first chance that he had to do it at such a high level with the ability to subpoena those people that were involved. We had uncovered money laundering trail, the money laundering of millions of dollars, and we had all the specific information. I even had bank account numbers and transfers of drugs money in and out at the highest level of our government. We even have a situation that I had discovered and all of the paperwork trail showing where the United States Treasury had made direct financial deposits into drug operations.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Bob, you go right ahead.
Well, the reason that I mentioned at the beginning, that I mentioned the Michael...
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a 4-tape or a 4-CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets that will protect your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances, even things which can cause sickness or disease? If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Berkey water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Berkey water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-730-9796.
Smuggling. Everybody in the world knows that the CIA is involved in the drug smuggling other than the American people. This is totally blacked out by the media, but certainly if we've talked to people from other countries, they understand what's going on. They understand that on one hand America has a war on drugs, on the other hand America, at least the dark side of our intelligence agents, are creating hundreds of millions of dollars, perhaps billions of dollars, to fund black operations throughout the world from the drug trade. And of course, drugs are very expensive because we have actually are involved in their growth and their distribution. Why simply would we control Afghanistan? Have we steadfastly refused to try to destroy the opium crop there? When the wicked Taliban were in power, why, there was very little in the way of opium being grown. Now that the heroic American forces are there, why, they have the biggest opium crops that they've ever had. Why is that happening? Well, Sonny Bono was going to ask a lot of embarrassing questions, but of course he never got a chance to call for the congressional investigations. He died on the ski slopes. But where he actually died was a long way away from the regular ski run, wasn't it, Bob?
Well, yes and no. Yes, you have the ski slope itself, which of course is a clear terrain with plenty of space both left to right as you're going down any of the ski slope hills there, and skiing. But the area where he was found was 100 feet to 120 feet inside the tree line off to the right of where he was going down. Now, so in terms of whether it was a regular ski slope, no. But people do go in and around and about the tree area. But when you do that, first off, this is an important point. You don't do it fast. You can't do it fast. It's one of these things where a highly skilled skier, which, by the way, Sonny was. Sonny was considered to be not just good, but expert. He was really good. And not like myself. I can't ski worth a darn. I've done it a couple times and was smart enough to not go back. But the area where he was found, it's impossible to go fast enough to smack the tree hard enough with a big enough velocity to just kill yourself. It'd be very, very difficult. It might happen, but very difficult. But it eliminates the idea that because someone had erroneously written once or twice in a few news releases that he had just drifted off, maybe was going high speed and drifted off and struck a tree. Well, that's not the case. He was, like you mentioned, not on the regular slope itself, but 100 to 120 feet inside the tree line. So he didn't just veer off to the left or the right and smack a tree at a high speed.
Well, weren't there some other trees around there down that he really would have had to have gone over before he could hit the tree?
Absolutely. It's unbelievably visible on, again, after, gosh, it took me some 6 months to get a hold of the footage, but we were able to get the footage that was shot of the exact tree and the location and the surrounding area. It was shot absolutely physically the day after when the sun came up There was still the yellow police tape up and all of that, accident scene tape that was up around on the trees. The tree that he theoretically struck, the handful of the things that were just didn't make sense at the site. One of them was that there was a large, like an 18-inch diameter tree, a big old thing that was a log that was now down and laying horizontally right in front of the tree that he theoretically struck. So he would have had to have hit, and it was quite snow-covered, but not enough that you can't see it. And he would have had to, he would have struck that first. Then there were boulders and rocks and things around in several other parts surrounding this particular a group of trees. And then also there was even a bush on one part of it. And so somehow they tried to tell us that he still struck this tree at such a velocity that it killed him instantly. And also, very important, and even the sheriff admitted it, and we have that on videotape, that the sheriff actually admitted, and the
hold that thought, we'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and that's certainly one of my favorite songs, and we love to play it here at this point in the program. And, of course, our guest this evening is Bob Fletcher, who's done an amazing number of excellent investigative video reports, and, of course, we carry, I think, all of them. We think that they are important enough. We feature them in our catalog, and we hope that many of you want to get the ones, especially on drugs and Sonny Bono. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly before we go on, Bob, I want you to go ahead and get your website out so people would know how to get in touch with you if they'd like to.
Okay, well, we have, as you mentioned, we've got several special investigations that we have done and completed on DVDs, and it's available to the general public. you can reach us or get a good look at what we've done, what's available at BobFletcherInvestigations.com. You just simply type in BobFletcherInvestigations.com. That will bring up our regular our personal location. You can contact us there. You can also, of course, anybody's interested can send an email at news@bobfletcher.info. That's news@bobfletcher.info.
All right, fine. Well, before we went to the break, you were commenting that even the sheriff had said, and then we knew it, never found out what the sheriff had said. So
right.
What was that all about?
Well, amazingly, the sheriff and also the autopsy verified, and the sheriff says on a live video, which we have included in our report, that Sonny apparently never put his hands up to stop himself from running into the tree. Now, it strikes me that unto itself should have been a sufficient red flag for somebody to say, hey, let's look at this thing carefully. That doesn't make sense. And that's not counting other technical parts of the autopsy that didn't fit, and, of course, the blood on his back, which does not fit because he had no wounds on his back. But the idea that anyone can be skiing at any velocity fast enough that looks like you're going to hit a tree, you automatically, by natural response, you will automatically put your hands up in front of your face, particularly if you're going head-on into a tree. There were no wounds to his hands whatsoever to indicate that it appeared he had done that. Therefore, both the sheriff and the autopsy, the doctor that did the autopsy, both specifically said that apparently he did not try to fend off the tree collision with his hands. That's ridiculous, all right, for starters. That just does not make sense. And if he was my son, or if he was my brother, or if he was my husband, et cetera, I would certainly want somebody to look more closely into his death just on the basis of those points. And again, like I said, the location was such that it was almost impossible to reach any high speed. Then when you look closely at the autopsy, I find out that, in fact, he had no trauma to his neck. And many people, most people, as a matter of fact, that when they run in, if you have an automobile accident, or if you run into a tree at a high enough velocity on a motorcycle, or you run into it on skis, most people actually die or are seriously injured because of trauma to the neck. You either get a broken neck, or you get a serious... Many people end up being crippled, and it's from the broken neck and, of course, the spinal cord being affected, from the head being jerked, slammed back. Sonny had no injury to his neck at all, no trauma to his neck. Now, if someone strikes you with a pistol, if you are pistol whipped, or if you were hit with a blackjack or a pipe or an iron bar or anything like that, or a fire poker from the fireplace or something like that, the person's hit in the head a couple of times violently, that will kill you, but it will not necessarily give you the trauma to the neck that you will get 95% of the time if you ran into a tree fast enough to kill yourself. So that was another point of the autopsy that was outrageous, besides the blood on the back with no injury. And then also the injury was described as and it was sort of to the right upper forehead, in that area to the head, sort of to the frontal area of the forehead and the right side. And what was very important in the autopsy, small technical point maybe, but that the bone was described where it was actually in his skull, it was described as having a couple of places that were of a curve and a curvature of the bone itself, where he had supposedly struck the tree. Well, the reality is if you strike a tree with an 18-24-inch diameter and you're wearing a wool cap and you smack it, the chances of you getting indented circular curvature indentions in the skull is almost impossible, and particularly the size, and it was the particular size was such that it would fit the front barrel of a .45 gun if you were pistol whipped, but it certainly will not fit in the diameter of an 18-inch diameter tree. So that was another bizarre little point that was right there in the paperwork, still is in the paperwork, and nobody seems to care. Additionally, the hat that I refer to, which was a wool ski cap type hat that Sonny was wearing, had disappeared. It never even arrived, apparently, at the doctor's office for the autopsy. Someplace between the time that Sonny theoretically struck the tree and the time that his body arrived for the investigative autopsy, the hat he was wearing vanished. Now, that's very important because, number one, it would prove the other side's point by showing possibly blood and particulate matter on the inside of this little knitted hat or, you know, wool cap, and also possibly wood debris from the bark on the outside. But with the hat gone, the cap gone, ski cap, with it just vanishing, we do not have it for evidence. We do not have the goggles. They've also disappeared someplace along the line. That also would have shown, because he was wearing typical snow goggles, and those would have been broken or whatever the case was, but they're gone also. They've vanished and don't show up on the inventory of goods. And then there's another small point. It's never been proven. It was brought to my attention by the lawyer that was working with Sonny's mother, and that was that there appears to be a special ring that Sonny always wore, had been wearing it for years. He had had it made for himself, particularly several years earlier. It's a pinky finger ring, and apparently that's gone. That did not show up in the inventory either. Now, whether somebody that would carry out a assassination for hire, a paid hit, whether one of those guys involved with that took that ring with him when he had killed Sonny or not, I don't know. That's, again, another piece of material goods that absolutely has disappeared and apparently was not with the inventory at all.
Well, now, why did the sheriff and the district attorney refuse to investigate any further if you raised the question that this certainly had certainly earmarks of a murder rather than an accident?
Well, I don't know. And again, of course, one point. Let's put it this way: if the sheriff, by the way, the sheriff is still there. The sheriff that carried out the investigation. And I can briefly read you a letter that was sent to myself after I brought these points forward to them. He says in his letter to me, he says, "Dear Mr. Fletcher, I have received your request for a copy of our investigative report surrounding the death of Sonny Bono at Heavenly Ski Resort. I am prohibited by law from releasing certain documents associated with deaths that occur in this county." See, now that's true, and there's a separate point that I'll mention in just a moment. He goes on and saying, specifically, "I cannot release autopsy reports and medical reports of the deceased. The only document that I can provide you is the coroner's official record. If you desire that report, I will send it to you." He also went on and says, "Finally, I must tell you that there was nothing in our investigation to suggest that Mr. Bono's death was anything but an accident. Accidents such as that are quite common in the Tahoe area. Additionally, because of the status of Mr. Bono, we took additional precautions to ensure the accuracy of the coroner's investigation. Period. And that's it. They never went any farther beyond that with any manner at all. I had requested from the sheriff, I had requested all of the autopsy, et cetera, et cetera. Now, what he did not know when he wrote this to me was that I already had all of the autopsy in general. I already had that. It had been supplied to me through the attorney, and that was part of the original inquiry for Mrs. Bono, Sonny's mother. So I already had all of that. I was just trying to find out, because there were other little bits and pieces of documentation, such as interviews by the witnesses of the people that had found the body, where they found it, when they found it, how they found it, and things of that sort. I was trying to get that. But for him to say, for example, that they had gone into taking special additional precautions to ensure accuracy, that's ridiculous. Because I, of course, having the coroner's complete investigation, I know that they didn't. That was baloney. Why in the world he would even say that? Or because I must tell you this also, no other investigation by any law enforcement ever took place in Sonny's case. Not the Secret Service, not the FBI, or any other office other than the Douglas County Sheriff's Department. They're the only ones that did it, that and the Sheriff Ron Perini. That was it. So there was no extra special, didn't bring anybody else in to go over this or anything. So that's a line of baloney. The statement that accidents like this happen all the time, is that his statement was accidents such as that are quite common. I don't know how common it is, number one, that somebody dies, because the truth is there's only one out of like 50 million skiers a year that die. One out of 50 million does not sound like a common thing. And for him, of course, to equate the death of a congressman as being common is also ludicrous. So why, I don't know. And likewise, I must say this. I had gotten a hold of the district attorney. They were pretty much the same way. They were very polite, but they did not cooperate. I did get from the district attorney's office a list of the inventory of goods that were found on the body, and that was partly where we discovered, number one, that the hat and the glasses were gone, the goggles and the hat were gone. I had already noticed that they did not show up in the inventory of the autopsy, and they did not show up at the police the report. So someplace that's vanished. Nobody seems to care about that. Nobody seems to care about the fact that a congressman of the United States government about to get into a major investigation was dead up on the ski slopes under unusual situations. It's bewildering. I can't, like I said originally when we started the program, we had all of this unbelievable attention for a rock and roll singer, not to take anything away from Michael Jackson as a performer or any of these other folks, but to have that amount of attention and to not be able to get anyone. I haven't even had anybody seriously challenge me. You know, I totally open up the door. I don't necessarily want somebody to just say, oh, well, you're right, and go along with what I said. I haven't even had anybody challenge me. There's nobody in major media, not a congressman, not a senator, not a police agency, not an officer, anybody has stepped forward, and it could be for good reason. If you're going to challenge me, then you're going to have to listen and go over what I've done.
Of course, the thing is that if they totally ignore you, why, nobody would know there's a problem. In other words, if they challenge you that this is a controversy, if they ignore you, why, of course, your message will be lost forever.
That's right. I would rather have somebody come forward at a high level of whatever, whether it's law enforcement or newspapers or whatever, major media of any sort, and have them say, you know, Mr. Fletcher, you are completely nuts. It's all it would need that, then let me respond. You know, let me respond to that kind of a statement. Or if I'm out in left field someplace, let me respond to that kind of a statement, because we've had none of it at all. And like you said, if you just ignore it, then you don't have to answer any questions or ask any questions that may give good answers. Because the investigations we've done totally stand on their own, and I invite everybody that's listening, if you have not seen our report, if you have not seen the report on the drugs connections to the CIA and other agencies, or you haven't seen the Sonny Bono investigations, you've got to get them and get a look at them. It's imperative. And then I also invite you to send a copy to any senator, any congressman, any police agency that you know, anyone at all that could help us out. You send a copy to them, and let's see what happens with it. But it's the idea that it's just been totally ignored it's bewildering.
Well, you know, of course, Senator Wellstone challenged the Bush administration as far as going into Afghanistan. His plane and everyone on it was killed in December of 2001. Certainly we know that Senator Tower, who was former Secretary of Defense, who was raising a lot of serious questions why he died in an airplane crash. We know that Congressman Larry McDonald, actually in KAL, Korean Flight 700, and of course when they did find the plane, there were no bodies in it. No bodies, no luggage. How could that possibly be? Of course, you've never heard these stories. And we could go down the line of the case of Ron Brown, a former Secretary of Commerce, when they had a bullet hole in his head, supposedly died in an airplane crash. We'll be right back. Well, you got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Heart disease is on the rise. Clogged arteries, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol levels may not be fully detected by you, but the symptoms are there. Loss of energy, blood sugar spikes and drops, poor circulation, and irregular heartbeat are just a few of these that can alert you that something is wrong. Hear how Heart and Body Extract is making a difference in thousands of people's lives across America.
My blood pressure has normalized. My diabetes has totally improved.
Everyone is telling me now how much healthier I look, and I'm telling everyone how much healthier I feel. I recommend Heart and Body Extract to everyone.
Anybody over 40 in the North American continent should be using this product as a preventative to keep their cardiovascular system healthy.
Order your 2-month supply today by calling 866-295-5305. That's 866-295-5305. Or order online, hbextract.com. Heart and Body Extract, 866-295-5305 or hbextract.com.
In these times of falling values, high unemployment, loss of income, and with hyperinflation on its way, we have created a 1-ounce silver coin with a cross and the words of John 3:16 on one side and the American Eagle on the other. These coins are mural finished, 0.999 silver. Each of these beautiful coins will always have an earthly store of value, plus the cross with John 3:16 as an eternal value. Go to www.john316coin.com and call 1-877-316-COIN while supplies last. Order these beautiful 1-ounce John 3:16 American Eagle coins today by going to john316coin.com and calling 1-877-316-COIN.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-730-9796.
Of course, we do hope that you'll want to get that material. We carry his DVD on Sonny Bono, on the assassination of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, on UFOs, on certainly on weather modification, on the exotic weapons that are available and mind control. He's done a great job of putting these together, and since he actually he inadvertently became involved with the CIA, they bought his company. He thought it was just a simple business arrangement without realizing that the toy company he was running, a very successful one, had now become simply a front for CIA money laundering and the Iran-Contra affair. And of course, it's an amazing story, and you can hear much of this in some of the DVDs that Bob has produced, including sections of his testimony before the United States Congress and the United States Senate. So if you'd like to get Bob's DVDs, our number is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to know about the CIA and drugs, let me suggest we have a four-tape set called The Men We Left Behind, and there you'll hear it, actually an interview with Monica Jensen Stevenson. Oh, going into the Vietnam War, The Men We Left Behind, and the fact that the CIA was involved with drugs. The CIA was actually taking the bodies of the boys that had died, opening them up the abdominal cavity, removing the intestines, and then packing them with drugs, and they needed the casualties so they could smuggle the drugs into the United States without any fear of being identified. We have a four-tape set. Is there really a war on drugs? Fascinating interviews with people who are on the front lines of this battle to prevent the drugs from destroying our country. But all you really need to do is stop and think about Afghanistan. How can it be that the United States controls Afghanistan, the largest producer of heroin in the world? Oh, we could simply spray those fields. All sorts of things we could do to stop the drug trade. The Taliban was able to do it. How about, of course, we can't do it? If you really believe that, ladies and gentlemen, the reason we're not doing it is not because, oh, we don't want to hurt the feelings of the farmers there. We want to have what would the farmers do for an income? The real reason is because the CIA is the largest purveyor of drugs in the world, but they cannot let the American people know that. Fortunately, we have the Internet. You can go up. There's a tremendous amount of information there. But let me suggest our four-tape set. Is there really a war on drugs? And The Men We Left Behind. And of course, we have other material on Vietnam. You've never heard the real story of Vietnam. We were never there to fight communism. Robert McNamara, who died a couple of days ago, they did not mention that he was the permanent vice chairman of the North American chapter of the Trilateral Commission. That Robert McNamara was a longtime member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Robert McNamara was the man who sent our boys to fight and bleed and suffer and die in Vietnam, but they were never to win. We were the greatest nation in the world was to fight a nation the size of the state of Mississippi for almost 10 long years, and we ended up losing the war. Do you honestly believe that happened by accident? And of course it didn't. But we can't tell the American people. We never went over there to win the war. We went over there as a diversion so they could bring socialism to America. And that's exactly what's happening now. We're maintaining this terrible economic crisis to justify the implementation of the nationalization of the health industry, the energy industry, the automotive industry, the banking industry, the nationalization of America. Our number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage, RadioLiberty.com. You can listen to our programs there. On the Internet, 9 hours a day and not get anything accomplished. Please pray for America. Pray for revival. But pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection.